The title for the evening talk is the Wisdom of the Middle Way. Sometimes when we look outside of ourselves, and particularly to particular trends and patterns in our society, seems that from particular ways of looking, there can be much perceived as extremes. And these extremes can seem very far from each other. And two which I have in mind, and fairly obvious ones to all of us, are secular and religious culture. And in Britain, as an example, in these various opinion polls which people have a fascination with, recently this year they asked women in Britain about their work that they do, and 80% of women said they would stop working and resign if they could afford to. 4 out of 5 women said they were not happy in their work. And it seems a hard way of life to actually go to work probably 5 days a week and not like and not enjoy what one is doing. And I don't suppose that figure is so unusual. They asked men who are supposed to love work what their response was to being at work. 1 in 3 men said that they regularly felt depressed about their job. Depressed about their job. And the work culture, which is now, I would say, obsessive, it's neurotic, is such that people are working in Britain, could be more in other parts of Europe, and probably definitely more in the United States, that people are working, on average, 50% more hours than they were 20 or 25 years ago. People are not working from 9 till 5, but are going in early to, as you do here, to avoid the traffic, are staying on later. And this is putting extraordinary pressure on families, on personal life, on emotional life, on social life, on outdoor life, on happy life. And men and women are trapped in this syndrome. And I was sitting on a train running from Heathrow Airport to into the city, into Paddington Station. And there was a young guy, probably 26 or 27 years of age, with the inevitable mobile phone glued to his ear. I think the babies of the next generation are going to be born like this. And he was saying to somebody on the phone, and as you know, if you're in a railway compartment, everybody is doomed to listen to the conversation. And he was saying to his friend, he's in at work at 7:30, working for a bank, getting home at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, being sent off to one bank in one part of the country and another bank in another part of the country, etc. And he said, "I want a life." And I was sitting right behind him. I nearly tapped him on the shoulder and I said, "You ain't going to get it with the bank." So sometimes the culture, the psychological culture, the money culture, the work culture, the efficiency culture, the profit culture, has human beings, has consciousness in its grip. Gripped it is with it. And when people have to pay so much for a mortgage on an apartment or home or high rent or whatever, and paying off the bills and the visa cards, etc., etc., it imprisons the psyche. And all of this is supposed to be telling us it's signs of a successful society. We've arrived, we've succeeded. And it needs protest, it needs change, it needs us all to look and to say, do I really have to live like this? And all the external impact on resources, on land, water and air, on people, on the environment, etc., etc. So any Dharma teachings and practices is very concerned with extremes, and it requires from each and every one of us to take a really honest look at our life and to ask ourselves, am I really a prisoner to all of this? Profit, prestige, money, possessions, having, gaining. Am I trapped in all of this? And sometimes a person may feel stuck and trapped and hate it, hates the work, hates studying morning, noon and night, hates all the pressure that goes along with it. But it will require digging deep for inner resources if we are to make any change, to find some intelligent way of living. These strange rocket scientists are always saying, is there any intelligent life on Mars or Jupiter? We're not even sure if there's any intelligent life on Earth. Why do we want to think about out there? There's one kind of extreme that the culture lives in. And teachings and practices are to encourage us to take a real clear look at that. And the other extreme, of course, is in religion. Any religion, Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, minor religions, New Age religions, etc., etc. And sometimes we take a look at that, and sometimes we ask ourselves, in all that's offered in the way of the tremendous variety of beliefs, huge number of things that you and I are asked to believe, it isn't always easy to find for ourselves what is really helpful, what really relates to our daily life. And that requires some discernment and some discrimination and some inquiry and some investigation to see, well, what really can work, can be helpful to uplift consciousness, and to find out what that can be. In Britain, which is a country which unfortunately I seem to know rather well, that the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's the head of apparently some 400 million Anglican Protestant Christians in Britain and overseas, mostly the old colonies or whatever, said in a talk, a lecture, a sermon, whatever it's called these days, said that in Britain the average age of church attendance is 67. Average age. And the churches in Britain just 20 to 30 years ago There was a priest for every parish. Even the small little villages of Devon, where Catherine and I and friends live, every 30 years ago, 1960s, every parish had a parish priest. Now, these poor parish priests, working as hard as the secular Wallace, are running from one parish church to another on a Sunday morning to cover six parishes, give their sermon, have the church service, jump into their old Ford, drive off to the next place, and then do another one. Mostly to speaking to 10 or 20 people in sitting in the pews, average age 67. It's hardly inspiring, is it? But nobody wants the churches to be sold. Nobody goes to them. But every village wants to preserve the church only for the architecture. And have a look around and say, oh, look at that person. That person died in 1630. Oh, bye. This is going to church in Britain. So there's this extreme culture which is going on, and it's become extraordinarily hard for people to say, how does it relate to my life, to my experience? So it seems like there's a whole middle ground or middle area which needs to be cultivated and developed. And it needs, I think, from us the capacity to see, well, what is useful in secular culture, but not become a prisoner to it? What is useful in religious culture without becoming a prisoner to it? So that somehow resources which have developed over years and over centuries means that they are servants for us. We are not slaves too. They are servants for human beings. We are not slaves too. And that change is a major change for humanity. And I'm talking of any secularism, any religionism, east or west, north or south. Last month I was in Spirit Rock in California. Spirit Rock is sister center to Gaia House and the Insight Meditation Center in Barre, Massachusetts. A number of friends here know Spirit Rock. One of the co-founders is Jack Cornfield, who, I may just put in a quick advertisement for Jack's latest book. He wrote a very good book called A Path with Heart, and he has a new book out. It's called After the Ecstasy Comes the Laundry. And this rather profound title is that he is found as a Dharma teacher over many years, and relates through his own experience as well, that sometimes people have very deep and profound and ecstatic experiences and great revelations and great insights, etc., and really feel changed and transformed by them, and that can be quite genuine, and then go back home from the retreat or from the monastery or from the trip to the east or from the community or from the desert or wherever, on a nature or wherever these experiences take place, only to find, metaphorically as well as actually, there's a huge pile of laundry. In other words, once back into daily life and all the issues of money and work and study and a place to live, and does one make a pilgrimage to McDonald's or not, and all of these decisions that go on after the ecstasy comes the laundry. So Jack has explored this difficulty, which a number of you know and are familiar there. End of advertisement. So at Spirit Rock last month, there was a meeting of Buddhist teachers, both Asian, Tibetan, and Thai, and others, and Western. And various themes, some 215 teachers, various themes were explored. I won't say the best, but certainly what was extremely pleasing to eye and ear was that in that total number of teachers who were present, all of whom didn't kind of go to this meeting because of space purposes, had to have done 5 years of teaching, that very roughly it was 50% women, 50% men at Dharma teachers, Buddhist teachers. And I thought that itself is a significant movement and shift from religions, and I'm talking East as well as West here, which there's a huge imbalance. You and I would be very much aware of this. And at the exploration that took place in the days of the meetings, again, not so much of an extreme, i.e. patriarchal and so male-orientated, but finding a genuinely middle way there. And in that middle way there, again, exploring, and that's what the meetings were about, ways to make teachings and practices more useful and effective. And for some, and I'm not one of those, but for some, what is important for some is the strongly religious aspect of Buddhism, i.e. statues, candles and incense, and guru devotion, etc. And I noticed when the Dalai Lama, who many of us love very much and have great respect for, that when he came into the Dharma hall, that he people were on their feet like a rocket. They were such affection and devotion. And then at the end, these little bits of red string were being given out and tied around the wrist. And I'm not quite sure, never have understood, but I've only been connected with Buddhism 35 years. What the purpose of the red string is around the wrist. But yesterday, Yael took Nina and I to a mausoleum of a Jewish saint. What's his name? Anybody? About 20 minutes. Babasari. Sali. All right. And to my surprise, there was an elderly Jewish gentleman out there with lots of little bits of red string in his hand. Now I know why it's called the Jewish tradition. So again, sometimes people have a natural affinity and connection with religious life in terms of its appearance to eyes and ears, to its appearance to eyes and ears, and it's important for some people. Most important, much more important than that, and this is what I want to attend to with you this evening, is not the outer forms. That isn't the really important thing. It is the very quality and the very nature of our inner life. We are so often preoccupied with and giving attention to what we believe in and what we disbelieve, what we like and what we don't like, secular and religious. And we forget very easily that those beliefs and what we like and dislike is not the important thing. The important thing is what's going on within us and how that shows itself. Sometimes persons may have, as it were, what they feel are correct beliefs, right beliefs. And most people feel, oh, my belief is the right one. That's why I believe it. But what accompanies that? What comes from the inside? Therefore, awareness matters from within. Love matters from within. Expansiveness and openness of the heart matters from within. And can that love and can that expansiveness find its expression in this world? That surely is much more important than being politically correct, religiously correct. Sometimes, and I was hearing a story tea this evening from Stephen. No, it's not unusual. Sometimes the word meditation is mentioned, and then there's a huge reaction by some people just to hear the word. Meditation is dangerous. Meditation is work of the devil. Meditation is emptying your mind and becoming brain dead. Meditation is a way of escaping from reality. Meditation is this, meditation is that. And how there can be strong reactivity to something which one doesn't, may not know anything about. One's just heard the word. So sometimes, coming to the immediacy of today here, sometimes we enter into a situation, and in entering into it, it's perhaps for a number of you, the first day you have ever been in such a peculiar environment as this. And everything seems a little odd. Someone has heard a little bit about meditation. One may have read a little bit about meditation. Some of your friends or even your family may have put pressure on you to come here, and you've been wondering, why did they want me to come here, etc. And the day itself seems very strange. It looks very strange walking very, very slowly. I mean, it looks odd. It is odd. Standing, doing nothing, is very strange. It's one thing standing and waiting for the bus, but standing and there's no bus coming looks to anybody who was unfortunate enough to be passing by this place today would think, what's going on? But I tend to take the view that since we do so many strange things already, why should we be concerned about two more called standing and walking or sitting still? So there's the day, and one starts off, and it does, for those of you who are new, has no relationship to anything that's familiar. One usually sits because one has a sensible reason for sitting. You know, sitting on the bus, sitting in the car, sitting in the office, sitting at the desk, sitting and watching the dreadful goggle box at home, or whatever it might be. So usually one has a reason for sitting. And it seems initially for beginners an incredibly poor reason to sit, to watch the breath. Because the breath has been going along all right for the last 10, 20, more than 10, 17, I think the youngest, 17, 20, 30, 50, 70 years. Why watch it? It's doing all right. So the actual giving of attention to something which is just going on seems a little wacky or a bit bizarre or strange. So when we are in the state of state of not knowing, we don't know if it's useful, we don't know why we're doing it, we don't know why we initiate it. When we're in a state of that, it takes a certain belief. It's a belief. It might be useful. It's a belief that there may be some benefit that comes out of it. But essentially, the inner movement that's going on is a movement from what is known to something unknown. And that unknown is the method, the technique, the form, the structure, the timetable, the whole cycle of the day. Could that which is unknown have a real relationship to one's consciousness? And the only way anyone can know is through experience. One person, I have people who write, one person left yesterday evening and said, "It isn't for me." Can be, why not? Some of us, I would say, it's a little bit early to make the decision. But why not? Any time can make the decision. So this movement, as I say, from known to unknown, is part of what we call the middle way of spiritual journey. I can say to you, and Catherine and Stephen can say to you, hey, look, we didn't invent this. We weren't sitting under some rotting tree in India thinking, let's go back to the West and make people's days as uncomfortable as we possibly can. All that one can say to give it a little bit of support is it's been going on for 2,500 years, from one generation of men and women to the next. And how do we know that? Because we've got 2,500 years of text to show it. We've got a tremendous history of people, practices, questions, answers, dialogues, experience that run way, way back for 2,500 years. We've got those dialogues and records and experiences in the Japanese, in Japan and China and Southeast Asia and India, etc., etc. And there has been a kind of unanimous, consistent thread which has run through all those years, which says that there is something about silence, stillness of being, and presence, and awareness, and meditative life, which is deeply significant. And all the insights and the transformations and the changes that have gone on, that it's something which has been, the spirit of that and the letter to it has been held all over these years in a wide variety of cultures and in a wide variety of circumstances. And you and I are rather in the contemporary generation of that. Everybody starts at some point. In the day, in the first of the day here, sometimes important questions arise, and they arise in relationship to the meditation. And I know some of you who are in the small groups today brought this up, and in the opening talk yesterday evening, reference was made to the importance of intention. What is our intention? And it takes a lot of inner work to be able to be clearly aware in our life of what our intentions are and the kind of impact our intentions have upon our own life, on the life of others, and on existence itself. So we've said, let's cultivate, for the purpose of calmness and clarity and well-being, the intention to be in the moment, the intention to be with the walking and with the breathing. And some of you, as you reported in the small groups, that even right from the very beginning of applying the intention, a lot started happening, and sometimes quickly. And one was finding oneself in some kind of struggle or agitation, or finding some things in the day very, very difficult. And with that difficulty, one can have the feeling in the difficulty of feeling quite enclosed and quite trapped. And then one feeds the difficulty a little bit more by taking a look at the timetable. I can't hack it. To start, it's bad enough working from 7 till 7 every day in the office, but these hours are even longer. And therefore the feeling of being And yet there is nothing which really traps us. We don't ask you how many times you sat today. Don't ask you how many steps you took in your walking practice. Ask very, very little. So sometimes in coming into a fresh situation, because of its unknown and unfamiliar, a huge, not small, a huge number of views and opinions start arising electrically quickly. What we're really saying is, it's unknown, it's unfamiliar, I'm not feeling very sure of myself, it's difficult to stay with that not knowing, it's difficult to stay with the unfamiliar, and the mind rebels. And then we find fault with everything except the food. Somebody, I think Catherine said last night, it's not gourmet vegetarian. Oh yes it is. It's in Israel. Retreat food is 5-star. I can tell you, I've been in 4 continents in the last 4 months. So sometimes there's the experience which is taking place of something which is unfamiliar and unknown. Mind is having a trouble and difficulty with it, so it rebels, and it shows itself in lots of resistance, doubt, agitation, views and opinions about oneself, others, this, that, and the other. That same situation may well apply in our daily life as well. It's the same mind. When something is unknown, and we're having difficulty to be with the unknown, it can easily generate lots of internal reaction about anything. One of our members of parliament, his name is Dennis Skinner, and he's regarded in Britain as the most left-wing politician in Parliament. He often likes to say that he's the only one left who believes in the class struggle. No, he's there. And earlier this year, not unusual, he's probably in his early 60s, I would guess, he had a cancer scare. Went for a scan, had cancer. And quite often, incident here, that people often think 1 in 10 people get cancer, approximately. That's the conventional viewpoint. Actually, it's 1 in 3 in the West. It's 1 in 3 is the figure. And he had some treatment, and then 2 months ago he had to return in May to the hospital to see the results, and therefore there was a waiting period, not unusual this, of not knowing what the results would be. Some situations, the mind can go crazy with worry and anxiety. Teachings and practices in life, amongst the many features of it, is learning and developing the capacity to stay with not knowing. So that the mind doesn't run riot. Because we practice to stay with not knowing. He was blessed. He went for the final health check, health report, and the physician said to him, "Mr. Skinner, you have got the all clear. Benign cancer, operated, cured." And Dennis Skinner, who's is usually regarded as hard a person you could meet, said that when he came out of the hospital, he said in May, he never in his entire life saw the blossom on the trees look so beautiful. And he said this last Sunday on a television program, and there was tears in his eyes. This is Mr. Hard Heart Dennis Skinner, the last remaining communist in Britain, with a tear in his eye. He said the blossom never looked so bright as it did, and when he came out of that hospital. So sometimes, in the experience of learning to stay steady with the unknown, in small things like here, one doesn't know what your day will be like tomorrow, nor the day after. And if we can just be rather patient with ourselves through the process of the day, maybe in all of that, today's difficulties, today's tears, today's agitation may not be tomorrow's. We can't make that and draw that conclusion. Today is today. And tomorrow we don't know. And today's relaxation, and today's, oh, how wonderful it is to be here, and today's, oh, I'm so glad to be here, and even the air conditioning is acceptable, or the absence of it, who knows how the mind will say tomorrow. So our taking and living and practicing one day at a time is part of the middle way, because it's the middle way between one extreme, which is the past, and the other extreme, which is the future. It's an enormous challenge and test for each and every one of us. Sometimes, as one or two of you brought up in one of the groups, yes, there is the intention to be with the moment, be with the breathing, be with the step-by-step activity. But then there may be a lot of inner movement at that time. And so one person was reporting in the small group, there may be emotions and strong feelings which are arising. And when those strong feelings which are arising, it isn't necessary to try to force oneself to be with the breath. Can we just be with what that experience is? Can we be with just what we're feeling in such moments? And therefore, there's a certain allowing that is taking place which says, oh, right now I'm going through a wave. I'm going through a wave of agitation. I'm going through a wave of negativity. I'm going through a wave of boredom. This has been the most boring day of my entire existence. Etc. This is the last word in boredom. Even the television is better. And one says, even that wave is only a wave that's passing through, coming for one reason only, to go. It's coming to pass. It's appearing to fade. And if we can bring into our awarenesses and our meditations kind of our outlook and attitude, nothing is worth clinging to. Nothing. Because we can't. We can't. We do our best, but we can't. We try to hold on, and we can't. We can't even hold on to into our life. So if we explore some of the themes of the middle way between past and future, between the extremes of secular culture and religionism, of any expression, we may find the middle way. if we can explore the middle way in terms of developing and training the inner life to be steady, steady with the known, to be steady with the not, with the unknown. We say there's something important about this, something sane about it, something, dare I use the word, intelligent about it. That if we explore that, maybe we will find a little intelligence on this earth. And maybe we'll find some of it in our own life. And if we find that middle way, then it will be not only of direct benefit for us, but also for our friends, our relatives, our neighbours, people near and far, for land, water and earth, for the creatures in the air, on the ground, in the water, whatever. All of that, to explore the middle way, generates a deep connection. That very much is our practice. And final word, such a practice and such a commitment to it keeps bringing us fresh insights. And I had a man on a retreat a year or two ago, a common story which I hear. And he said to me that through his business, he had over the years become very, very wealthy. He said, I have so much money. He was about 60 years of age. He said, I have so much money, if I live another 20 or 30 years, I couldn't spend it all. And some people, God knows why, some people would be impressed to hear that, and some people may even foolishly aspire towards that kind of affluence. And immediately after saying that, there were tears in his eyes and his body began to shake with emotion. And he said, I've got all this money, and apart from immediate family, wife and a couple of kids, he said, I haven't done anything for anybody my whole life. I've wasted it. And just sitting on that meditation cushion has just shown me how much of my life I've wasted. And he said, it's a terrible feeling to have inside of myself. And one could feel the anguish of this particular man. So I said to him, it's never too late to start. You're going to have to start today giving, serving, doing for others. You start today. Till the day you die, you start now till the day you die. And to his credit, there's resolve and determination and resolution. And so on the retreat, got him working, got him doing things in the garden, got him doing things for other people, etc. So see, sometimes in our looking at our life, it isn't easy to be very clear and honest with ourselves. And in that, saying, okay, what are the steps which are necessary? Maybe in this funny old practice of sitting and doing nothing, walking up and down and nowhere to go, standing around all day for no reason, maybe in the ordinariness of it all, something will begin to stand out clearly and beautifully and insightfully. Maybe. May all beings
live with awareness.
May all beings
explore the practices of the middle way. May all beings find illumination in life. So let's have a couple of quiet minutes together, shall we?